Welcome to From Wealth to Wellbeing, a podcast for families who know that their most important assets are their family members. I'm your host, Jenna Dunay, Chief Learning Officer here at Arlington. In this podcast, we'll help you proactively navigate the very human challenges that accompany wealth, get insight from industry experts, and share the latest tools and techniques to integrate a learning culture into your family. Let's get started. Welcome to From Wealth to Wellbeing. In this episode, How to Build a Thriving Family Amid Wealth, we'll be chatting with Arlington Advisory Board member and prolific author and thinker, Jay Hughes. Jay is one of the leading voices, if not the leading voice, on family governance, wealth preservation, and generational well-being. Jay walks us through why historically it has been a challenge to have a thriving family when financial capital is involved. Next, Jay helps us unpack what it actually looks like to have a thriving family and introduces the concept of seven-generation thinking. And then finally, how to start assessing where your family is thriving or not. All right, without further ado, let's get into my conversation with Jay. Well, Jay, we just want to thank you so much for joining us here today to talk a little bit about the key to preserving wealth for generations. So before we get into all that lovely stuff, why don't you just introduce yourself and share a bit about the work that you focus on?
Well, Jenna, thank you. This is a great privilege. And to all of you listening, thank you for sitting by the side of the river for a half an hour with Jenna and I to talk about the question of wealth as well-being and the wealth of your family as well-being and its thriving. I'm Jay Hughes. I'm a junior. My father was James E. Hughes Sr. I'm junior. I've been at this for 76 years. I'm going to be 80 next year. And when I was 4 years old, I overheard my mother and father having a heated conversation. I don't know if they knew I was there or not, but I listened in. And my mother was worried about money, which she worried about all of her life. And she was explaining to my father that she had come home one day from school at the age of 16 and found a for sale sign on her front lawn. Now, she was a daughter of a very wealthy man who in turn was the eighth of nine living children of a very, very wealthy man. They'd had servants in the house and she couldn't imagine what was going on. So she went inside to see her mother. She said, "Mother, why do we have a for sale sign?" She was telling this to my father, on the front lawn. And my grandmother said to her, "Well, Betty, your father has gone bankrupt, 1936. And my mother said, "What?" She said, "Yes, she's lost all his money and invested it in deposits in his father's bank, was run by his brother, and the bank had gone busted." And my mother said, "And so my grandmother said, "Well, we have to sell the house." And then my grandmother said something even more amazing. She said, "Oh, and by the way, Betty, I'm going to work." My mother said, "What? Mother, you don't work." And my grandmother was the only child of very, very good parents, adored her, cosseted person. And she said, "Well, Betty, I have to go to work because your father doesn't know how to work." And that was true. He knew how to shoot. He knew how to fly fish. He had wonderful stories. He was one of the great friends I ever had growing up, and they lived in our home, but he didn't know how to work. So my grandmother went to work for 50 years in a hospital receiving all the visitors. Well, Jenna, from that day since, and here's the last thing my mother said to my father, we experienced shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. I won't tell you more stories because I want to take more time, but I want our listeners to know that I have spent the last 76 years trying to find an answer to avoid that outcome. Avoid the outcome of shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. And for those who wonder what that means, let me assure them it has nothing to do with money. It has to do with family. Does the family have a longer than three generation deep connection in which each person seeks to enhance the journey of happiness of every other person?
So this work for you really is not just professional, but also personal, from personal experience. So that's what kind of gets you up in the morning.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I want to try to help anyone I can meet, has nothing to do with money, have a family that is generative and that is contributive. And I'll say it again, in which each member seeks to enhance the journey of happiness of each other toward all of the boats rising, toward the whole family having a thriving experience.
That's amazing. Well, we're so lucky to learn from you and to sit by the river alongside you. So like we said, today we're talking a little bit about the key to preserving wealth for generations. So I would love to hear your perspective. What do you feel like people get wrong about the idea of wealth, this concept of wealth? How do you look at it?
Well, Jenna, let's start with the dictionary. As all of your listeners know, I'm a lawyer. I've had a law license for 54 years. My father was a lawyer. My grandfather was a lawyer. My great-grandfather was a lawyer. There were two generations before that. I'm six. My son-in-law is seven, and my new granddaughter is eight. So words matter in our family.
Yes.
We live on words. We eat words, I guess you could almost say. So words matter hugely. And when people ask me the great kind of question you just asked, the first thing I do is go to the dictionary. I think about, well, what do the words mean? In our field, there is an endless conversation about wealth, W-E-L-T-H, W-E-A-L-T-H, wealth. What does it mean? The dictionary makes it very clear that wealth means well-being. The word wealth comes from an Anglo-Saxon word, weol, W-E-O-L, and you find that word today in commonwealth, commonweal. The same word exists probably 1800 years later, 1600 years later, a long time. Mm-hmm. And wealth means well-being. So the question that I believe families want to engage with each other in is, let's talk about wealth as well-being, because that's actually what the word means. And coordinately, so same time, same space, same consciousness, if we're talking about our family's wealth as its well-being, then we must be very discriminating. And whenever we're talking about wealth as a thing, we want to talk about financial capital. We want to be really careful in our language with each other that when we use the word wealth toward thriving and flourishing, we mean well-being of everybody. All boats rising. Feel that? Mm-hmm. All boats rising. And if we're talking about wealth as a thing, then use the term financial capital to describe it. So we don't get confused about what wealth actually is.
So you're saying there's a difference between financial wealth and then wealth holistically, it sounds like.
Well, entirely. In fact, if a family is really conscious and it looks at its balance sheet, what is the balance sheet? Well, balance sheet tells you what an enterprise, a family's an enterprise, after all, but want it to last for seven generations, not even three. It wants to look at its assets. I'm not going to spend any time today on liabilities, but I'm going to spend time on assets. What are a family's assets? And we said, what is he talking about? What does he mean, family's assets? I said, well, it occurred to me a long time ago that family assets consist of five different kinds of capital. First is spiritual capital. Do we have...
And how do you define that?
Well, do we have a common purpose that's mm-hmm. larger than ourselves? Mm-hmm. Now, I could put it in very simple terms and say, will we have a fourth and fifth generation of our family who are flourishing? And that's the... I said simple. No. It's the most complex thing anybody ever imagined trying to do. Mm-hmm. Very simple to say, oh, we'll have a fifth generation of that come to Thanksgiving dinner, all 200 of them. But the complexity of the process from here to there, oh my goodness. And by the way, that's about 200 years of work from here to there. Mm-hmm. So, but that's the goal. The goal is that there's an overriding purpose and vision that human beings in this thing we call family, two or more of us, because family has to be two or more, can't be one person, two or more of us, all those years in the future, those human beings are flourishing mm-hmm. and in community with each other, at least at some level. That's spiritual capital. That's a transcending, transforming vision. And then you have social capital, which is how do we do making decisions together? Oh my goodness, is that important? It sounds easy. So I'm just going to tell our listeners how difficult it is.
I don't think it sounds that easy because I know my family.
Okay. But I'll just give you a hint that there's a book, I'm not going to suggest you read it, that makes it very clear that 70% of families fail. Not because of bad lawyering or bad accounting. No. They fail because when they're joint decision-making system mm-hmm. is required to make a hard decision, it either doesn't even have such a decision system or it can't make it work. Bad odds.
So it really just proves your point around it's not just about the financial capital.
No. And by the way, we've only gotten two of five capitals.
Two of them,
only
right.
Two of five capitals. Five capitals, he said? Yes, two. We've got spiritual capital, overriding purpose. Mm-hmm. We've got social capital. Can we make a decision together? This is in a simple way, how do we govern ourselves? How joint decisions.
Right.
And then comes the third capital, intellectual capital. Are we a learning system? Are we absolutely committed to every single person learning everything he or she can all the time? And then comes the key, sharing what we learn.
Mm. Practically, what does that look like?
Well, I'm going to say very simply, getting in touch with you every single day. And I'll say, Jenna, what do I need to learn today? What do we as a community need to learn today? Right?
Right.
I mean, and you know that, Jenna, mm-hmm. and Arlington knows that. By the way, families think they know that, but they don't. I'll give you one quick example.
Perfect.
If a family doesn't know how every single family member learns, then its intellectual capital is in deficit. And its social capital will be impossible because it won't get the information in each mm-hmm. hand in the best way it can be understood. So it can't make good decisions. And then that overriding purpose of that five generation or seven generation journey will fail because there's just going to be confusion. If intellectual capital is present and learning and people are learning and know how they learn, then they're much more likely to come to the joint decision-making process with the information absorbed the way they best absorb it. Then they're likely to make good joint decisions. And guess what? Their vision of that long purpose is going to come to life.
Hmm. So it's all interconnected as well.
Absolutely.
Right.
And then the fifth of those capitals is human capital. Is each human being thriving to the extent of his or her greatest individual capacity to do so? Now, the interesting thing is, but you said J5, the listeners say, well, you said five. Wait, those are only four. So spiritual, social, intellectual, human. What's the fifth? Financial capital. And it's the fifth because it's on the bottom. It's what supports the growth of the four qualitative capitals. So fifth capital is quantitative, financial capital. And it's the engine that drives the ability of the four qualitative capitals to grow. That's what the asset side of the balance sheet of a thriving family looks like. It looks like all those capitals are on it. All those capitals are growing, and all those capitals are leading to a thriving family.
So really what it sounds like is the key to preserving wealth for generations is to look at wealth differently. Number one is to look at it as well-being. And number two is really to identify it's not just about the financial capital. It's really around all those other pieces of the puzzle that contribute together to generate a thriving family when we put wealth in its place and define it properly.
Exactly. And just to add to that and sort of refresh, the four qualitative capitals are the keys.
So not just one key, four keys.
Four keys. And in the order of importance that I stated them. Spiritual capital on top, social capital next, intellectual capital next, human capital next, supported by the single quantitative capital, financial capital. It isn't just that there are five, there's an ordering of importance so that each supports the growth of the next as you move up the hierarchy.
That's really good. Can you elaborate, I think, just a little bit more on the human capital part of it? What does that look like? We talked a little bit more in depth about spiritual, social, intellectual. And before we kind of move on from that, I'd love to dive a little bit deeper into the human capital of how do you see that playing out in a family?
Jenna, I came to the view many, many, many years ago that the core vision of families that I saw that succeeded into their fifth and sixth generation is that they were following a principle that I call enhancement. They were actually working every day to enhance each other's individual journeys of happiness. Enhance is one of those wonderful words. Remember, I said lawyers love words. Enhance is one of those words in English that's only positive. You really can't negatively enhance. Webster doesn't permit that. So what I'm saying about human capital is, what is it that we're seeking to enhance? Health, individual intellect, learning. What I would call well-being. What is that well-being of that individual person we're seeking to enhance? Are they finding vocation? And then perhaps to say in these terms, Sigmund Freud, who got many things wrong that Jung got right, but that's the problem of being pioneer. Sigmund Freud got one thing really right. He said, Jenna, that the most adjusted, and that my terms, happiest people he met were those who learned to love and those who learned to work, meaning vocation. So love that lifts up, empowers someone else. And work is vocation, by which he meant calling. What is that human person called to do? Not labore, not work in the labor, but vocation. Freud is right, in my opinion. So anything we do for each other and individually that helps us learn to love and helps us learn to work is going to help us be a thriving human being. Now, Freud was also very careful. He said there are two things that will take away for adjustment from happiness. Two big ones. Sex, by which he meant gender, not simply sex in the reproductive sense. And then comes the biggest one of all, money. And he said money is the most difficult of all because no nice person will speak of it. Now, Freud said that in the 1890s, 1920s. I've been around the world probably 100 times, literally. I spent most of my working life in the 1970s and 80s, early 90s, outside the United States. I lived in the East Coast and then here in Aspen, but I traveled and my clients were from all over the world. I can assure our listeners that discussing money remains, despite Freud's great admonition, pay attention, the only thing about which nice people cannot speak. It is unintegrated. It is a huge problem. Now, what I would say is if it's spoken about in the context of learning to love and learning to work, at the integration of love, the integration of work, then while the gender issues are complex, I think we're doing pretty well as a society in dealing with them. Money, no. But we get money to be financial capital, so it integrates into a process of learning to love and learning to work, the individual person learning to love and work, the whole system learning to love and work. Freud is going to say, you got it right. You figured it out. You saw what it meant to have a thriving individual life, and then how that contributes to your couple life, if you choose to couple two people, how it contributes to your ability to help your children thrive. He's right. Love and work, sex and money.
I love that. So we talked through all five of the capitals, four of the qualitative capitals being the most important and the financial supporting that. Let's say somebody's listening to this podcast right now, and beyond the impetus to reach out to Arlington and myself, what would you suggest would be a practical thing that a family who's listening saying, I totally understand where you're coming from, Jay. I agree with you. These other capitals are really important. Now what? What do I do and how do I start integrating that into my family? What advice would you give them? And I think that would be a great way for us to close out for today.
Love them to pieces. Help them find their individual journey in life, that vocational question. And I always think it's good to remember what John Adams wrote to his wife, Abigail. And John Adams was a serious man. By the way, a great lawyer. He won one of the great and most complex lawsuits in America when he defended the British Army for having shot down people in Boston. He succeeded in defending them. Quite a remarkable man, and then became our second president. But John wrote to Abigail, and he said essentially, and I'll paraphrase this, he said, I was forced in my life to study war and politics. So my sons and daughters could study animal husbandry, navigation, useful things. So my grandsons and granddaughters could study porcelain and music and statuary. What I would say is love them to pieces and find out who they are, not who you want them to be. Who are they?
That's a hard
one. Who are they? Why are they on this planet this time? And what is it that they are called to do? And then do everything you can to help them discover that and embrace it. And above all, invest in them in that way.
That's so good, Jay. Thank you so much for joining us here today to talk a little bit about the key to preserving wealth for generations. We learned a lot of great information, and we just thank you so much for your wisdom.